Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicoast. Today is August 4th, 2017, and this is episode 46. Politicoast is a podcast that explores what's happening in British Columbia and across the country. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicoast Pod, and please support the show at patreon.com/politicoast. I'm Ian, and this is going to be a bit of a different episode from our usual format. I'm out of town, so I'm recording this intro without Scott, but we still do have a full show today. On Tuesday evening, we Skyped with University of Victoria tax economist Lindsay Tedds for a wide-ranging discussion on tax policy covering basic income, foreign buyers tax, empty homes taxes, and a bit on the NDP leadership race and minimum wages. And after that, we'll have a few snippets from Jean Swanson's announcement also on Tuesday morning that she's running in the by-election for Vancouver City Council. Finally, there's no quick takes this week. Next week's also going to be a sort of special episode before we return to regular programming later in August. First, let's roll the tape on our conversation with Lindsay Tedds. So we're sitting down over Skype with Professor Lindsay Tedds. Welcome back to the show, Lindsay.
Well, thank you very much for having me.
Perhaps you could introduce yourself a bit for those who didn't hear your earlier interview and maybe who you are and what you research about.
Sure. I'm an associate professor in the School of Public Administration at the University of Victoria. And I'm a little bit of an eclectic researcher. In general, my area is in the field of tax policy, but I have researched from the area of the Canadian underground economy all the way into the field of Canadian exploration expenditures, the implementation of a basic income, regulatory charges and user fees, and even fertility expenditures. So if it's related to tax, I will study it. So, very eclectic.
Speaking of your research, you recently published a paper about implementing a basic income guarantee. Can you walk us through that?
Yeah, so if you don't know, in Ontario, they announced in the 2016 budget that they were going to proceed with piloting a basic income. And this was building off of the MINCOM experiment from the 70s. And as a result of that, the Northern Policy Institute wanted to hold a bunch of workshops on how to go about implementing a basic income, which I think was a really great idea, because this idea of a basic income, I think, is a great idea. Lots of people, you know, think about it as, you know, great, you know, give people money, lift them out of poverty. But the devil is in the detail, and this is what's missing in their conversations about a basic income, is how to go about implementing it. So the perspective that I brought to this was, if we were going to go about implementing it through the personal income tax system, which a lot of people think is a great idea, what are some of the benefits? What are some of the barriers, and what are some of the bothers with doing that through the personal income tax system? And so I ran through these complexities that we see with implementing a basic income, all the way from, you know, dealing with the tax collection agreements, all the way then through to even thinking about tax evasion as well, and how that impedes our ability to implement a basic income. And where I leave it is that while the personal income tax system is a great way to implement a basic income, before we even go down that, there are a lot of things we need to fix in the personal income tax system before we go as far as implementing a basic income through the tax system.
So through the tax system would basically say, would it be more of a sort of negative income tax, where if you don't pay a certain amount, you get your check?
The way that it has mostly been argued, and Hugh Siegel was the one who provided recommendations to the Ontario government. He wanted it as a refundable tax credit. So very much like the negative income tax system. That was sort of the things that we're looking at. But even if it's, as long as it's anything other than just a universal payment to everybody that is not clawed back, there's some real systematic issues that you have to look at within a basic income. Like if all you want to do is give everybody $2,500 a year, you know, none of these issues really matter other than trying to find everybody. And that's still a big issue no matter what you do. It's really hard to find everybody to give that money to. But as soon as you want to start thinking about, you know, clawing it back, you know, one of the things you have to think about is, okay, one of the things that we have as a feature in our tax system is that there's only a certain amount of income that we tax. One big part of income that we don't tax is things like the proceeds from principal residence. We don't tax strike pay. We don't tax things from tax-free savings accounts. We don't tax lottery, inheritance payments, and things like this. But when you start thinking about a basic income guarantee, amounts from those kinds of activities start mattering for the payment of a basic income guarantee. And so these are the things we have to start thinking about how is our tax system structured and how do we have to start thinking about transforming it if we're going to start delivering a basic income.
And so would you have issues with, say, CEOs who take a $1 salary but get all their income or I guess compensation through stock options and things like that, because I guess people wouldn't want to see a CEO worth $10 million or more getting the same check as a homeless person.
Oh, I mean, yeah. I mean, it's stock options that are reportable income, but what I would be more concerned about is the CEO exercising stock options in 1 year. So let's say they exercise their stock options, they get a $10 million reportable income, but then they don't have any income for the next 20 years, which means under a basic income for the next 20 years, they're going to get a check under the basic income, right? And so lumping income like that is actually quite problematic under a basic income. And that's another thing that I talk about. Under previously, I don't even remember when we stopped doing this. We used to do income averaging under our tax system for individuals, people with lumpy income, self-employment and what have you, so that we always looked at what was your income over a number of years rather than just on an annual basis. And that was to ensure that people who had lumpy income didn't pay, you know, either high tax or didn't get benefits paid over just an annual basis. We would factor it over a period of time. But we don't do that anymore.
What are some of the other kind of top level changes that would need to be made to our tax system in order to implement a basic income?
One of the biggest problems is the tax filing. Only people who owe taxes have to file their taxes. So 40% of Canadians don't actually have to file taxes because they don't owe any taxes. And if you don't file, you're not going to be able to claim your basic income. And now this is something that has come up with regards to the Canada Child Benefit and populations such as Indigenous people. Because they don't owe any taxes, they're not filing their taxes, and that's perfectly legal because of the tax owing positions that they are in. But as a consequence, they're not getting the tax benefits that are owed to them. So we really have to rectify the system of tax filing and the payment of benefits to ensure that our way of filing is more aligned with the benefit payment system. And one of my recommendations is that we move to a pre-populated tax form in order to be able to do that. But that means we need to have a perfect census of everybody in Canada to be able to fill out that pre-populated tax form.
And I'm taking it we don't have a perfect census by any stretch.
Certainly not with marginalized communities. That includes Indigenous, it includes homeless, and these are target people for a basic income guarantee.
So with this work, could it translate to the theoretical pilot project the new BC government would be looking at?
Absolutely. While the paper was written for the Ontario pilot, the principles are perfectly translatable to any province wanting to enact a basic income. Because, of course, we just learned, what was that last week, that the federal government is uninterested in pursuing a basic income. So this is going to be up to the provinces to do this as long as the Liberal government is in power. And so it is going to be up to the provinces. And as a result, that really takes away a lot of the ability of provinces to have any power over the income tax system, because, of course, they've signed away their ability to do so under the tax collection agreements. So I think this really complicates things and really inhibits their ability to implement a basic income guarantee through the personal income tax system.
Maybe it's beyond the scope of the paper, but are there other ways they could do it besides through the income tax system?
I'm sure there is, but as a tax economist, what do I know?
You
know,
fair enough.
I know about the tax system. You know, I mean, we deliver social assistance to individuals at a provincial level. We don't use the tax system to do it, so clearly there is a way to do it. One of the benefits, though, of the tax system is the social assistance system has that stigma associated with it. Right? One of the reasons why advocates of a basic income like the tax system is because it doesn't have that stigma associated with it. And so if we don't use the tax system, whatever system we use cannot have that social welfare stigma that comes along with welfare payments.
Well, let's maybe move into a bit of a discussion on the foreign buyers tax. It's the 1 year anniversary since Christy Clark's previous government brought it in last year. I think it was 1 year ago last week. Maybe you could talk a bit about what the impact of that's been over the last year.
So yeah, we have numbers till the end of May. That's what's been available up on the open data portal. So, you know, we have less than a year of data available, and, you know, it's fairly aggregate data that we have access to. So it's, you know, it's not perfect. It has a lot of problems with it. One of the things that we are seeing is that according to what is reported on the property transfer tax return, is that it does, the foreign buyer property tax surtax did seem to have an impact of reducing reported foreign buyers in the Metro Vancouver area. And in particular, it affected, the tricky part was that, right, they just started collecting data on foreign buyers, right, in June. And then they announced the foreign buyer property transfer tax on July 25th. So we didn't have a lot of data before they announced this transfer. So we know before the tax came in that foreign buyers in Metro Vancouver were like 9% of buyers, but we don't know how accurate that was because, of course, the fact that they were even looking at it really drew people into the market and accelerated purchases. So, you know, I'm skeptical of whether or not that's an accurate representation of how much they were of the market. But once the tax came in, they went right down to, you know, about 1% of the market. They've since rebounded to about 4% of the market, but that varies across the municipalities in Metro Van. One of the biggest municipalities is still Richmond, and I don't think that would come as any surprise to anybody in Metro Van. We're still seeing Richmond is having the highest proportion of foreign buyers. But we did see an interesting drop in foreign buyers once China started enforcing their yearly conversion limit, and that happened in the beginning of January. So that seemed to have an impact on particularly Chinese buyers being able to come over to Canada. think more important for those of us who live in jurisdictions that didn't have the foreign property tax put on it. So we are, in fact, seeing an increase in foreign buyers in those jurisdictions. And I live in one of them, and that's the District of Saanich, which is the biggest municipality here in the Greater Victoria region. They've only been collecting that data since January 2017, but on average in 2017, the foreign buyers account for about 10% of the market here. So higher than what it was in Metro Van before the property transfer tax came in over there. So I think there is, in fact, a real concern over here as to whether or not there needs to be greater attention paid if there, you know, people are concerned about foreign buyers. I'm not sure there needs to be a concern, but I'm just saying that, you know, if foreign buyers brought in the foreign property transfer tax in Vancouver, then people need to start looking at Saanich.
So when China started enforcing their currency conversion rules, there was a drop off of it, which would obviously indicate a sizable chunk is Chinese in origin. Does the data break down the source of foreign purchases?
No, not in the public data. Unfortunately, it's just all foreign.
Is there any possibility or evidence that the foreign buyers may be just going through domestic shell corporations or any other sort of workarounds to the tax?
Yeah, the public data, again, won't tell you any of that. You know, somebody whose original tax area is in tax evasion, I am more than acutely aware of, as soon as you put a barrier in, you know, there's people who get paid a lot of money to find a workaround to that law as fast can be. So I am confident that people who have a lot of money and want to buy real estate and don't want to pay that tax, are they avoiding the tax? I'm confident of it. I mean, I'm not, you know, none of us are dumb people. We know they are. What I think would be telling is that if you could get into the micro data, is if you were able to have some information about their representatives, you know, if you had some information about the purchasers and if you knew who the representatives were, and if you could see enough trends, you might be able to impute something. But in the end, it would still all be supposition.
This was pitched as a help affordability, kind of keep some of the excesses of the market from getting wealth too excessive. Is there any actual data that shows this has had any real effect on it? Anecdotally, it seems like the housing market here is still pretty hot and nowhere near affordable or even trending in that direction.
You can get the from the Canadian Real Estate Association. They have their home price index up on their website, and you can get it for Greater Vancouver, which is not as fine of a detail as you want to see. But you can sort of look at some trends coming out of that. You have to remember that we did have a cooling of the market that was coming in before that transfer tax came in. And everybody forgets that. We were seeing a cooling of single family homes just in the spring before that transfer tax came in. And I think it's important to keep that in mind. People were warning, not warning, but we're talking about it. And what ended up happening, though, was once that transfer tax came in, there was a big cascade, right? If you remember the stories that were coming out, when one person can't close, it's not just one closing, right? There's usually a multitude of closings that can't happen. So there was a cascade through the system where a number of properties couldn't close all at the same time. People got cold feet. People stepped back and sort of went, oh, I'm going to wait and see how this is going to unfold before I get back into the market. So not only was there a little bit of a cooling that was happening, but then there were domestic buyers that weren't sure what was going to be happening with the market. So yeah, we absolutely did see a very short short, very short downturn in the market, and it has very much rebounded. Single-family homes are still off a little bit, but townhouses, apartments, and one-story houses are way up off of where they were before the property transfer tax came in.
On a related policy, about a month ago is when Vancouver's empty home tax tenancy deadline came into effect, July 1st. Do we have any initial hints at whether that's going to have any effects?
Well, I think it's too early to tell. Wasn't the deadline just last month or just a couple of days ago?
Yeah, it was July 1st, I think, was what we have written here. I don't know if that's true.
Yeah, I think it's still going to be about 6 months before we see any data come out of that. And then how we're going to see that all ripple through, because with that is also that Airbnb tax that they've brought in. They're allowed to post up on Airbnb if they're renting out a portion of their principal residence. They have to have a license and all of this kind of stuff. You know, so we're seeing a number of things sort of come together all at the same time. I think it will be interesting to see how this all unfolds, how quickly it will address affordability without there being anything related to the zoning problems that are going on in Vancouver. I'm somewhat skeptical.
How difficult will it be, since all of these policies are kind of coming in at once, to tease apart the, you know, cause and effect of specific policies? Or is it just kind of a guess game almost at this point?
It will depend on what data people will be able to get access to that will really determine how much you're going to be able to do. I mean, with any hope, with this new government in the province coming in, maybe we'll see some loosening up of data that will allow researchers to be able to try to tease out some of these things. But yeah, I mean, it doesn't help when they do more than one thing at a time. They should know better.
Well, speaking of the new government, there's a few items in the agreement they put together, and as well as the mandate letters that came out. Do you have any comments on those?
Well, I don't think there were any real surprises. I mean, I expressed a great deal of disappointment about the Minister of Finance's mandate letter. It was so, ho-hum. And it was so uninspiring. The Minister of Finance is such an important job, particularly for this NDP government, who has a lot of really important initiatives. And there were a number of initiatives that were not cross-listed into the Minister of Finance's letter. And there was that vague sort of, I don't even know what it was. It wasn't even a promise. It's, you know, we're going to improve tax fairness. I have no idea what that means. Like, is that, you know, is this going to be something about, you know, improving, you know, progressiveness? Is this about the tax mix? Is this about, like, what is that about? I mean, at least I was really kind of hoping that the NDP would have learned something from the Green platform. I mean, you know, the NDP platform was just so disappointing, and a lot of people expressed a lot of disappointment about it, that I thought they would have learned something from it, but apparently they didn't. Because at least they could have looked at the Green platform and have seen what they had in there. Because it, I don't know if you remember, but in the Green platform, they went right at it. They said, one, we are going to get rid of all those boutique tax credits. You know, they're nothing but a waste of money, and let's get rid of them. Second, we're going to establish a working group to overhaul the tax system, reverse the trend of aggressive taxation, streamline and simplify the tax system, remove perverse incentives. Rock on. That sounds great. And then they could have, you know, learned from Ontario, where they are cracking down on the underground economy, because this is a really good time for this government to take good initiative on taking some very important steps. You know, when you're not in deep fiscal constraints, you know, the province is doing well. The coffers are full, so to speak. Now is also a good time to take some steps of cracking down on the underground economy, because people don't take it the wrong way. Now they can take some steps to establish a working group to do what Ontario is doing, which is really working on cracking down on the underground economy, working on tax evasion, and getting those tax resources that this government is going to need when the next contraction happens. Because it's going to happen. We're always going to have another recession. Now's the time to do it, not when there's going to be another recession. And then you have the fiscal room so that you don't have to stop the progressive agenda that they've already started. And so that's what I think is most disappointing, was the lack of leadership in some key areas that I think this government, this could have done really well for this government in the early stage of its mandate.
Maybe it's more of a political angle, but with the sort of weird interlude we had there where the legislature sat and Christy Clark tried to bring forward this throne speech, in the midst of all of that came out the sort of, I guess, leak of the budget sort of before it had been properly audited, something that wouldn't, the fiscal update as it were, that showed this giant surplus, which everyone, it seems like, is probably realistic, like they didn't just make it up. But is that possibly where the NDP is maybe a bit hesitant to not be seen as the party that takes a surplus and just throws a bunch of taxes on it all at the same time?
Well, but it doesn't have to throw a bunch of taxes on it. It had in its platform a whole bunch of taxes. And what I guess I'm saying is that if it had more leadership in that finance minister's letter, is that you can get those revenues without those taxes simply by, you know, having a effective tax code, cracking down on tax evasion, delivering, ensuring that people are paying the taxes they're supposed to pay, and, you know, getting rid of the nonsense tax credits that liberals brought in that don't do anything except for, don't get me started. Sorry. You know, all they do is cost money. There's another way to save money is also getting rid of all of this administrative oversight, because to deliver on all of those boutique tax credits, we're paying Canada Revenue Agency to administer those tax credits on our behalf. It's absolutely ridiculous that we do this. That now's the time to do this before then their next budget, they're going to be announcing that high income surtax. And they actually have more fiscal room than they think they do if they took some initiative on what I'm talking about here before they have to go to that room. I always say, before you raise taxes, you should first and foremost ensure you're collecting the taxes you're supposed to be collecting. Your first step shouldn't be to increase your taxes. It's collect the ones that you're supposed to be collecting.
Do you think BC has a revenue problem at all? I know that's a big issue in Alberta where, well, depending who you listen to, the people in the United Conservative Party think they're being taxed to death in Alberta, but
let's
sort of leave that in a box by itself.
Yeah, let's leave
it there. How do you think BC's sort of overall tax system is working in terms of revenue generation, setting aside also the stuff we just talked about in terms of making sure it's collected effectively?
I think we have to be careful. Alberta got dependent on oil revenue. This province is dependent on revenues from real estate. You know, if you look at how much, I mean, it's almost $2 billion that we're collecting from that property transfer tax. You know, this province is, in fact, going down a slippery slope, much like Alberta. I think we really need to be careful about that. When the housing market collapses, that is going to be something that is going to cause a lot of problems around here. When we look at how competitive our tax system is, and we have had under the Liberal government, the first one was in 2012, the last one reported in, I think it was in November. We've had, you know, two fairly serious reviews of the tax competitiveness. Interesting, both of them led by an Albertan. And pretty much the thing that keeps coming out is you got to get rid of the PST in favor of an HST, but God forbid we actually put our big boy pants on and revisit this discussion, because there's so much political fodder about this. You know, I really I really hate that we can't go back to this simply because, what was his name, Gordon Campbell, you know, screwed up the implementation of that. You know, the PST is a terribly inefficient tax to have. We would do much better with GST-HST, and we could implement it such that it was unregressive. I can't believe I just said unregressive. It could be progressive. You know, and we've had a number of studies that have come out to show how you can do that. You can make that tax just like what they're doing in Alberta with the carbon tax, right? You can make these taxes progressive. And, you know, we really need to be able to have a much more mature discussion about that. And that's what I would very much like to see. You know, when it comes to our income tax, you know, I really would like us to be able to move away from taxing income. You know, I'd prefer us not to be taxing what people earn. I'd like us to be taxing what people, you know, you want to tax what people take out of the economy, not what they put into it. But there is a role for an income tax, and BC is fairly competitive. It's not competitive, though, with this horrible MSP premium that we have, which we absolutely have to get rid of. And that takes us back to the minister. I think this was in the Minister of Finance, or was this in the Health Minister's
both,
letter?
I
can't
believe.
Remember. It was in both. I cannot believe the NDP are sticking with this 50% reduction with this morass of an implementation plan on this MSP. They don't need a blue ribbon panel on how to implement an MSP elimination. Eliminate it, roll it into the tax system. This isn't rocket science. This is not hard to do. It's not going to take 4 years to do. The lack of leadership on this file from the NDP is embarrassing. I don't know why they think this is so hard. Again, they should have been reading the green platform and how to do this, and this could be over with. The cost to the economy on this implementation that rolls out on January 1st is just embarrassing, and I can't believe they're moving forward with it.
Okay, let's move on to the NDP leadership race. Is there any one of the candidates' policies they put out or ideas they've expressed that you'd like to comment on or has some important implications for how we would manage taxes?
Well, you know, I haven't been following it too closely, but I'm sadly married to a social democrat. But he doesn't follow politics, so I have to inform him on his his voting duties. I think we're both fairly enamored with, and I'm probably going to massacre his name too, Jagmeet Singh.
Jagmeet, I think I've heard it pronounced.
Is it mostly. Is it Jagmeet Singh? You know, I think as you guys know, I'm a red Tory, and you know, as I just said, my husband's a social democrat. I see him as being able to win back the NDP voters who turned to the Liberals because the NDP were no longer the NDP. You know, it's a very attractive platform. I think it is attractive because it is of his approach to ensuring that low-income individuals get richer benefits and that those of us higher up in the income spectrum no longer get these benefits. I'm perplexed by an NDP, and there's several of them, but particularly Charlie Angus, who seems to think that people like me should get universal benefits. Like this baffles my mind. Anytime a government wants to throw money at a household like mine, I'm like, I don't understand you. You know, as somebody who's fiscally conservative and socially progressive, as soon as you start giving me money, I know there's a problem. Like that's when the conservatives lost my vote. So I really am keeping my eyes on him. I think he's really got the potential to take on the Liberals in 2 years. And I really think that in the NDPs, I think that's why he's bringing in more new members, because I think he's bringing them back.
Do you think there's any overall benefit to more universal programs? I know that's what Nikki Ashton promotes on, sort of free university for all, or I guess maybe even Guy Caron's basic income pilot project that he's proposing.
I do not. Well, I mean, only when there's a, you know, a market failure that promotes it. You know, with university, the primary gains to university accrue to the individual. So no, I don't see a rationale for a free tuition for everybody. I see a real benefit to providing greater support for low-income individuals, because the real barrier for lower-income individuals going to university is not tuition, it's the living costs while going to university. So providing free tuition actually doesn't allow lower-income individuals to go to university. It allows, like my son, to go to university for free. It doesn't make any sense. So for the most part, no, I'm not a big fan of it, because again, providing benefits to my household is just, I just don't get it. So, and then with Ikra, who I really do like, I've had the pleasure. And I'm working this fall with my students on really getting into the nitty gritty of a basic income. We're going to go through a lot of literature. We're doing it as a case study. But at this point in time, I really don't see it as the wherewithal that everybody thinks that it is. I mean, his plan is fairly rich. It's going to be based off of the LICO. So at least his is going to be different depending on where you live, which I think is the first time I've seen people change it depending on where you live. And it's going to be joined with the CCB and the GIS. But I don't see him have costed it. I've been on his website. I don't see it costed. This is an expensive plan. And people, again, when it comes to something like a guaranteed income, people need to be able to understand how much money something like that is going to cost and how much in taxes or how much in services they have to give up in order to be able to get it. And I think we need to be cautious about going down that road.
Well, last week we had on Nikki Ashton, and you were kind enough to send us a couple questions through Twitter, which I tried to do my best to relay. One specifically talking about her efforts to both tax, I guess, capital and wage gains equivalently. Maybe you could sort of better express than on Twitter what your sort of thoughts are about the issues with that plan.
Right. So what she wants to do is, yeah, equate, I guess, capital gains will be taxed at the exact same rate as labor income. So I'm incredibly empathetic to raising the capital gain rate. I am in the Carter Commission, a buck is a buck is a buck. But we have to remember that capital gains aren't the same as labor income. One of the biggest differences is labor income is earned every year and taxed every year. Capital gains sometimes are earned in a year, but more often than not, there's a holding period. So I acquire an asset, I hold on to it, maybe I hold on to it for 20 years. Then I sell that asset. That capital gain then has 20 years eaten away by inflation. So if you tax the whole capital gain, then you're actually taxing nominal gains, not real gains. And therefore, what you're doing is that you're taxing it at a higher rate than labor income. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it does.
Yeah.
Okay. So one of the purposes of having a lower rate on capital gains is to rectify that inequality, to ensure that you're only ever actually taxing real gains. So you want to tax real labor income, you want to tax real capital gains. Now, if 50%, taxing only at 50% is not appropriate, I mean, because, you know, inflation's only been like, what, 1.2% a year? And we don't attach a holding period in order to be able to get that preferential rate. Down in the United States, in order to be able to get the preferential rate, you have to have held on to it a particular period of time. So I'll agree with her capital gains treatment, equating it to labor income if you've held on to it to less than a year. But as soon as you've held on to it for any particular period of time, there has to be an adjustment for this real versus nominal gains. We have the tools and techniques to allow us to be able to do this in any way, shape, or form. Our tax system, I think, is far too simplified, you know, at this, you know, no matter what, you get this 50% discount. But I think that she needs to very much think carefully about what it is that we are taxing and why it is that we tax it the way that we do.
That might be the first time I've ever heard someone complain the taxes are too simple.
Only on that case.
I was going to say, well, Nikki would also bring in a wealth tax, an estate tax, a financial transfer tax, so there'd be lots more for you to do.
Finally, there's the financial transaction tax that she's proposing of 0.5% on the purchases of stocks.
So this is the Robin Hood tax. So so the property transfer tax is a Robin Hood tax. Any time you have an asset that's changing hands, if you tax it, this is a tax like this. And so it's just meant to stem speculation.
Do those work in general, do you think?
The literature indicates no, that it doesn't curb speculation at all. It's just for the purposes of revenue accumulation in the hands of the government, which I understand she likes to do.
You got to pay for big social programs, I guess.
You got to pay for big social programs. And so this is on stock options. Is that what you said?
Purchases of stocks.
Okay, so this is everybody. I mean, everybody buys stocks, whether it be through, you know, their pension plans, their RRSPs. Just, you know, everybody now is a stockholder. So we'll all be paying this.
I think the hope is to slow down stock trading a bit to prevent massive
high frequency trades.
Yeah, to prevent the massive crashes that happen when everyone flees at once.
Right. Yes, these high frequency trading, they were all the rage after the 2008 financial collapse, right? Everybody said it would have saved the world. Blah, blah, blah. I don't think anything would have saved the world from, you know, dumb people buying asset-backed commercial papers, because we still see people buying them. Do I think it's going to do anything? No, I do not. But it will accrue revenue. So, and that seems to be, I think, probably more what it's meant to do.
All right, well, changing gears a little bit then. One thing that still comes up in the NDP wheelhouse, both at the provincial and federal level, is this idea of raising the minimum wage to $15 an hour. How many people do you think that would benefit versus potential downsides?
So this is just at the federal level.
Well, it's being proposed both provincially and federally.
Yeah, I mean, the federal one, I know this was dealt with at the last federal election. It's a couple hundred thousand people. At the provincial level, yeah, because we're looking at this in BC, Ontario, Alberta. You know, this seems to be the new movement. And, you know, we're seeing new evidence come out. We've got the Seattle minimum wage studies come out. We're getting new evidence out of that. We have a new study that has just come out from researchers at the University of Waterloo that's looked at it across the Ontario provinces. One of the things that we do have to remember is Canada is not the United States. Most of the research that's coming out of the United States is minimum wages that are set well below where Canada is. And I know that one of the things that we look at quite a lot is the relative difference between where the minimum wage sits compared to the average wage. And the ratio in Canada is much higher than what it is down in the United States. So what we do see is that the higher the ratio is, the more likely is, and the higher the degree of unemployment, reduced hours, and therefore worse economic effects from a minimum wage. But this is all just now boiling through the academic literature at this point in time. And so it is a fairly controversial topic.
So do you think a perhaps better alternative might be to raise the working income tax benefit? Would that be more or less effective than a minimum wage hike?
You know, I think we certainly want to raise the WITB, the working income tax benefit, no matter what. It isn't rich enough. So I think no matter what, the WITB does need to be raised, because even when the minimum wage is $15 an hour, you still have a significant number of working poor. I think you should divorce those two. You know, I'm an economist. I find it really difficult to say, you know, this is what you should do, this is what you shouldn't do, because I'm not entirely sure what goal you're trying to achieve. And even read this with the mandate letters coming out from the NDP government. They have a number of different initiatives that, you know, it's not entirely clear across the spectrum what they're trying to achieve. They got the minimum wage, then they've got this living wage commission, and they've got a basic income guarantee, and they're raising, you know, welfare rates and disability rates. You know, it starts to get a little confusing as to what exactly we're trying to achieve overall. Overall, I'm not opposed to a minimum wage, but we all know that there is a sweet spot to the minimum wage. We do not know where that sweet spot is, but we are going to know when we've surpassed it. And I think that's all I can really say definitively. Like, I mean, come on, we all know logically, if you raise the minimum wage to $150, we're going to have problems. So we know there's a sweet spot to it. We just don't know where it is.
Do you think there's still space for that to be raised in BC right now?
Well, I mean, our minimum wage right now is like the lowest in Canada. It's raising to the fifth highest is either September or October. I can't remember what exactly the date is. So once we hit there, we're like the fifth highest in Canada. So we've got some movement going on fairly quickly. And that's not under the NDP. That's under Liberal policy, which I assume will still go forward. So, you know, yeah, that'll put us at, what is that? So September 15th, it raises to 1135. And that puts us fifth highest in Canada. But Alberta's at 1360. And it goes to 1360 on October 1st. So 1135, and if we look at what our average wage is in BC, so the average wage is 2795. Yeah, so your ratio, that puts you at a ratio at 0.4. They probably have some room to raise it, but not much. If you're worried about how close you can be to the average wage before you start seeing negative economic impacts.
Okay, and finally, can you tell us a bit about the University of Victoria School of Public Administration, and you know what it is, what do public administrators study, and what are you known for?
Well, so yeah, the School of Public Administration, we're primarily a graduate school. We do have some undergraduate programs. We do have a minor as well as some certificates, but most of our training is at the graduate level, and we're mostly known for our master's in public administration. We have both a campus-based program and an online program. And so with the online program, if you're a working professional and don't want to quit your job, you can still do a master's degree. And we're the only ones that doesn't have a residency program. So that can be quite an attractive feature. And our campus program is targeted to your traditional students with an undergraduate program who wants to come and study on campus. And we, you know, with the public administration, we're one of the few traditional public administration programs left in Canada. We are not a public policy program. Those are all the rage right now. We are still a public administration program. And so here you come and you, you know, this is more focused on learning breadth rather than depth. And so you learn more management skills. You're going to learn things like consultation, negotiation. You learn research. You learn economics from yours truly. And who else would you want to learn it from? Seriously. And you take your fall courses, and then you get to go off on a co-op term. And then you come back and you're going to learn things like public sector ethics, governance, policy process, leadership, financial management, and statistics. And then you go back out on another work term, and then you come back and you do a project. So you end up with a broad base of skills that puts you in good stead for getting a job in the public sector or in the nonprofit sector. And this is a really great selling feature. 98.5% of our graduates are employed within a year of graduating from our program.
Was there anything else you wanted to get in, or maybe you could just tell people where to find you and hopefully we'll pick that up?
You can find me at the School of Public Administration.
Or like on the internet. What's your Twitter?
Oh, on the internet. Oh, what's my Twitter? At Lindsay Ted.
All right. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
All right, have a good
Bye.
Night.
Next up, on Tuesday morning, anti-poverty activist Jean Swanson announced her bid for Vancouver City Council. Here's what she set out as her major policies.
So number one, rent freeze. It's not acceptable to me or most of the young folks who've been pushing me to run that the average rent in Vancouver, get this, is now more than the total monthly income from a full-time minimum wage job. And so that's why we're calling for a four-year rent freeze. Okay, so technically this is a provincial power, but I want to be an activist counselor working with tenants, using city powers and facilities to push as hard as we can for a four-year rent freeze for all tenants. We are announcing my run for city council in front of the Belvedere because the tenants here are fighting back against being evicted so the landlord can renovate and charge higher rents. Our policies would stop this. First, we'd require landlords who go for building permits to prove that they've contacted all their tenants and informed them that they'd have the right to return at the same rent after the unit is renovated. The form would simply be a modification of the existing development application form. Secondly, I intend to work with people like the Belvedere tenants to push as hard as possible for a Vancouver rent freeze. This would include delegations to City Council and the provincial legislature, passing motions at council, holding news conferences, and basically any creative actions we can think of. Okay, policy number two, end homelessness and tax the rich. We want to actually end homelessness by building enough modular housing units to house all homeless people in Vancouver. 2,138 counted last March, until we can get proper social housing built. This would cost about $160 million. Housing a homeless person actually saves about $20,000 a year, so this investment would pay for itself in less than 4 years. The province will save on its health services, the city will save on policing, and can cut the police budget. If senior governments won't give us the money, we'll demand the powers to tax the rich in Vancouver. It's obscene that some people live in $75 million homes while others live on the street. The city needs to be able to tax mansions more than ordinary houses, and large corporate businesses more than neighborhood stores. We'll fight for those powers. We'll get that money by hook or crook. We're also looking at policies that would undo other injustices. We need to expand our sanctuary city policies so police don't report people to immigration and border services. When citizens work their heart out, uniting young and old to save their neighborhood from developer condos, like the folks in Chinatown did with the 105 Kiefer fight, council needs to genuinely respond to what they need, not simply give the developers another okay. We need real democracy. Homeowners are automatically put on the voters list, but tenants aren't. And permanent residents can't vote, even though that was proposed by the Independent Election Task Force. We need actions to ensure that renters, Indigenous people, and other racialized groups, as well as permanent residents, can vote in the 2018 election. For over a decade, Indigenous people have been calling for an Indigenous Healing and Wellness Center. That's way too long to wait. If we cut just 2% of the police budget, that would be over $5 million we could invest in community services that promote justice. And we need to start working now for free transit for all to keep people out of their polluting cars and promote mobility for people who can't afford buses. We could start with a $5 a month pass that Calgary has for low-income people. The point is that we need big changes, not the same old, same old. I want to stir things up in that chamber and help build movements for justice. Three more things. As of today, I'm resigning as a Carnegie Community Action Project volunteer, so I won't be speaking on behalf of them during the campaign. Number two, this campaign won't take money from developers and corporations. And number three, if elected, I would keep only $44,000 of the $85,000 salary, since $44,000 is the average Vancouver wage. I think it's easier to identify with issues of people who have average incomes if you're one of them. The rest I would donate. The rest I would donate to a group or groups working for justice.
In response to questions about why she's running as an independent and not throwing her support behind prospective One City nominee and other anti-poverty activist Judith Graves, Swanson said she's responding to the movement that's built behind her, particularly among millennials and young people. She said she's hopeful she'll receive an endorsement from left-leaning COPE here in Vancouver, but ultimately she felt she just needed to get her policies out there sooner rather than later. She also set out her respect and admiration for Graves, but she felt that she and One City weren't pitching the policies that the city needed to tackle inequality or affordability. In the questions, I asked whether she would support congestion charges as a tool to reduce traffic in downtown Vancouver, and she responded she hadn't really looked at the issue yet. I also asked her about the affordability of her ambition for a free transit program, particularly in light of the need for mass transit expansion in Vancouver. She said mostly fares go to fund operations rather than capital expenditures, but we could just tax the rich to sort of make up for the shortfalls. As the by-election campaign heats up and candidates come forward for the recently announced school board by-election as well, I'm sure Scott and I will have the chance to delve into these policies and more at some point in the coming months.
And that has been Politicos. Finalists, the stories you mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politicos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.